From 90.9 WBUR, this is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks in Manchester. Coming up, New Hampshire votes in the nation's first presidential primary.
I probably knocked on about 1,000 doors this weekend, and everybody's been very, very positive, very welcome.
I'm so glad today is here because now our phones will stop. It is just crazy.
I think she's realistic. Washington's a tough place, and she's going to go in eyes open.
Out of all the candidates, he seems the most honest to me. And
he's willing to stand his ground and do what is right for the public.
With polls closing in less than 4 hours, we'll assess the state of the Republican and Democratic races and what's at stake.
Also, disruption is a big theme of the presidential race so far, but is the special nature of the New Hampshire primary changing as well?
We're live with reporters, analysts, and New Hampshire voters all this hour on Radio Boston.
First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in Boston.
And I'm Anthony Brooks in Manchester, New Hampshire.
It's just a few hours until the polls close in New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary. After all the debates, the town hall meetings, the diner meet-and-greets, Granite State voters today are deciding who they want for president, many at the last moment as they enter the polls.
Their choices might not be who ultimately wins the presidential nominations, but this primary will have a lot to say about how the process moves forward. So there's a lot at stake. American politics itself may be at a turning point. As we've traveled the state over the past 4 months, there's a palpable feeling out there, a frustration, a yearning for political disruption everywhere, it seems. Just listen to these voters in Manchester and Merrimack who told us this morning who they're voting for.
Trump, of course.
Well, because I like the way he talks. He's got the you know what, to stand up to people.
Ted Cruz, all the way.
Mind telling us why
well,
you like about Cruz?
He's willing to stand his ground and not become a mainstream Republicans in Washington and do what is right for the public.
Chris Christie. You know, last second decision, I heard him on the TV this morning, and he said he was pro-life for the whole life. That worked for me.
Marco Rubio. Well, I think he's the best guy to be president next.
I voted for John Kasich.
Tell me why.
Who the hell knows? I mean, I listened to him on the radio, and he seems to make sense, and that's it.
Hillary Clinton. I'm a little weepy. It's really historic. Boy, did it feel good to see a woman's name on there, color in the little circle. It's amazing.
Bernie Sanders.
Tell me why.
Bernie, I think that he understands the nature of how America works a bit better. I'm not all about a revolution, but at the same time, unless somebody does something pretty extreme, nothing is going to change. And I think that Bernie Sanders understands that a lot better than most.
Well, this hour, we're on the ground in the Granite State. We'll check in with reporters and analysts, and we'll talk about what the New Hampshire primary is telling us about the state of American politics overall.
In every election, candidates call for change. But listeners, what's going on this time? Does it feel different this election cycle? Are you yearning for disruption? Give us a call. Join our conversation this hour, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
By the way, you can also find us on Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. And Anthony, actually, I was wondering if I could start with you. You're there in Manchester, and you've been in New Hampshire for a couple of months now. So what are you thinking about today?
Oh, boy, a couple of things. There's just some huge questions that I'm just dying to get answers to. And I think this all points to the huge uncertainty that we're all, I mean, those of us who've been watching this for months, even hours away from the polls closing, it's really, really hard to predict what's going to happen, especially on the Republican side. So that's hugely interesting. Mm-hmm. Big questions on the Democratic side as well. I mean, folks are expecting a Bernie Sanders win, but how big a win? And is it going to allow Hillary Clinton to claim some kind of victory if she can come back and get close to Bernie Sanders? But I think, the theme, Meghna, that you and I were just hinting at in the script there, this idea of disruption and
right. Really
kind of mixing things up. And it's a theme that runs through both sides, both the Republican side and the Democratic side, because a lot of folks out there really are feeling that this system isn't working for them anymore. Trump, in his way, speaks to that. Bernie Sanders speaks to it in a big way. So that's what I'm thinking about right now.
It sounds like there's a lot going on there. And as you said, we'll see how much this actually plays out when we get the returns coming in this evening. By the way, WBUR is going to be covering returns from New Hampshire all night long. But Anthony, you've got someone up there who's got a pretty good perspective on this as well.
Absolutely. Let me introduce Dante Scala. He's with us here in our Manchester studio. He's associate professor of politics, of political science at UNH, and he's the author of The Four Faces of the Republican Party, The Fight for 2016. For the 2016 presidential nomination, which came out last year. And Dante is one of the sharpest observers of what's going on up here in the Granite State. And Dante, it's great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Good afternoon.
So I'd love to start with you with just this idea of uncertainty. Is that what you're thinking about when we sort of talk about where we are right now, just a few hours before the polls close?
Yeah, I'm thinking about that all the time. It's like a cloud hanging over my head. And just because there are so many different ways, especially on the Republican side, this could play out. And there's nothing more volatile than a presidential primary with multiple candidates, many of whom have had very competitive campaigns up here. For a lot of candidates, the buck stops in New Hampshire. It was New Hampshire or bust. So it's been a very robust campaign season. And then put Donald Trump on top of that, who scrambles a lot of the traditional categories in which Republicans fall. And it's just a formula for a lot of uncertainty. Lots of voters, I suspect, woke up this morning after sleeping on it and might have made up their mind on the way to the polling place or on the drive home tonight.
You know, I think you're right. And I was so struck by, I mean, I was out talking to voters as recently as yesterday, and I was struck by how many people still hadn't made up their mind. But speaking of this uncertainty, I want to sort of talk about that theme in a couple of ways. First, when it comes to Donald Trump, I mean, I'm probably not going out on a limb to say that he could well win. But as we learned in Iowa, the polling wasn't necessarily reflected in the votes that he got out. So that's sort of one of the uncertainties here in New Hampshire. Is he gonna perform really well in the way that those polls suggest?
Yeah, and the challenge there is voters with a low propensity to participate who are not habitual voters. Has Donald Trump done enough to light them up and to stir them to come out to vote when that's not something they typically do? I mean, going to a rally is one thing. Lining up maybe for half an hour to wait and vote is something else. And so that's a key question. And there's, again, as in Iowa, real questions about whether Trump bothered to build a traditional ground game. And, you know, the thought before Iowa was, well, maybe those things don't matter because it's Donald Trump. But it did turn out that it did matter there.
Right. And hey, Dante, can I just throw a question in as a follow-up to that? I mean, sure. The polling for Trump has been in, you know, the big double digits. I mean, so what is a win for him here? Like, if he wins by 5 points, is that essentially an optics loss for him?
No, I suspect not. I mean, I think for Donald Trump to win New Hampshire is a signal event, and certainly he will praise himself to the high heavens if he does so. And I think it is a big win because no one expected Trump to get this far, including myself. And I think it will, no matter if it's 3 points or 13 points, I think a win's a win for Trump. And he goes on to South Carolina, able to say he righted the ship after Iowa.
Yeah. And what about the rest of this sticking with this theme of uncertainty, the rest of the Republican field? Do you expect it to narrow after we get results after today's vote?
I do think that at least one or two of what I would describe as center right candidates will drop. I mean, we have Chris Christie, Ohio Governor John Kasich, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio. I could imagine one of, you know, that's four right there, and there are only three spots at the top, and I'm pretty sure Trump's going to at least get one of them. So that only leaves, I think you still have to finish in the money. I know it's a weird year, but I think you have to finish somewhere first, second, or third to have a reason to fight on and in South Carolina. So I think we'll get a little clarity, but it's not sure. I mean, a week ago, it looked like Marco Rubio was doing very well and that a second place here would basically cut off the other quote-unquote establishment candidates. That's feeling a little more uncertain today. And if others rise up, John Kasich, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio may have a lot of competition going into South Carolina.
Hey, Dante and Anthony, stand by for just a second, because speaking of Marco Rubio, we're actually joined now by NPR's political reporter, Asma Khalid. She's in Manchester as well, and she's been following Rubio and his campaign. Asma, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, happy to be here.
So tell us, I mean, you know, after this weekend's debate performance where Rubio seemed to take a pretty big hit, what's he been like on the New Hampshire campaign trail for the past couple of days?
Well, he's been more or less repeating that same Obama debate line that he was, you know, sort of famously mocked for on the campaign trail. And when he did that, he emphasized the fact that he was bringing up this point again because it's a point that's very important to him, and he consistently feels that, you know, President Obama is changing the country. So he tried to sort of spin it, and I will say it was well received by the crowd. I mean, I spoke to a number of voters who said, we understand that point, you know, we don't think that it's that big of a deal that he was reiterating it, that Chris Christie might have been bullying him a bit. But that being said, these were, you know, campaign events for Senator Rubio, so he had sort of a friendly crowd out there. There were also some undecided voters that I spoke with, and what I think that's really interesting about Senator Rubio's campaign here in New Hampshire is when you talk to people who are undecided, they're sometimes torn between him and, say, some of these establishment moderate governors that we think of, say, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush or Ohio Governor John Kasich. But then just as often, I met people who would say, you know, I'm torn between Marco Rubio and Ben Carson, or Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. And so he seems that he's able to sort of be the Republican for all in a way that, you know, I think as Dante was saying, there was that thinking that he could really consolidate some of this support and move on really strongly out of New Hampshire. And maybe the debate hurt him. I don't know. I mean, I feel that he's still bringing out really large crowds. And I'm not really convinced whether the debate really did hurt him.
Hmm. It's a really interesting point, Asma, because I saw him on Sunday. I believe it was Nashua or Londonderry, I believe. And I was struck by how many people I spoke to. I mean, I spoke to a handful of people at that event who said to me they were Rubio supporters until they saw that debate performance, and they were really rethinking it. And now, of course, that's just a handful of people, but it seemed certain. At the same time, I was also struck by what you observed: big crowds, big enthusiastic crowds. But Dante, I'm just wondering, is this what your view of this? Is this something that Rubio bounces back from?
You know, the difficulty is, and the irony is, that Marco Rubio was such a steady, good debater all year. And the one time where he slips up is at the very end when it's most important. I think he could, I mean, it's possible he could recover, and that we're really looking in the dark here, trying to figure out what voters are thinking. But the problem is there are so many candidates to choose from, and there was so much uncertainty in the electorate. Rubio had something going, but I don't think he had clinched the deal with a lot of those people who said they were on board. So they were late deciders getting on board, so it's almost like a bandwagon, like first, last on could be first off and going to search elsewhere. But, you know, we'll find out. That Asma's point is well taken in the sense that Rubio's appeal was that he could appeal to a wide spectrum of voters, from moderates to very conservative religious voters. Everyone found Rubio at least somewhat appealing as a second choice. The question is how many will. You can only make one choice.
Right.
And that's going to be the question here tonight.
Well, Asma, I know you've got a lot more reporting to do today, so we'll let you go. That's NPR's political reporter Asma Khalid in Manchester. Great to talk to you again, Asma. Thanks so much.
Great to talk to you, too. Take care.
Well, gentlemen, if I could just bring in one more voice here before we take a break. He's Stephen DeSalvo. He's president of St. Anselm College, which, of course, has hosted many a debate over time, including the one that got all the attention this weekend. President DeSalvo, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So let me just throw a quick and maybe not so easy question, but I mean, how have you felt? How have things in St. Anselm's College and around New Hampshire felt to you in these last couple days before we arrived today at primary day?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of energy here, and we've had all the candidates on campus, and then hosting the debate on Saturday, it really focused people on some of the issues that we're talking about now. I just want to just add to the Rubio conversation. I was voting in Bedford earlier this morning, and the Rubio bus pulled up, and he got off, and there were three young people dressed as robots, and they're on the front of the costume. It said Marco Rubio, and they were, you know, playing on the fact that he was very robotic on Saturday. I think that his slip-ups could really hurt him today, and he got rattled even when he saw these folks. So, you know, there's a lot of animation around this campaign. You look at what's happening at the polls with a lot of people turning out. With these choices in front of us, I think there might be some surprises tonight.
You know, it's interesting, Mr. DeSalvo, to hear you talk about that. I saw those guys in the cardboard boxes dressed up as robots. But when you think about the particular kind of mistake he made, I mean, Chris Christie has cast this as he melted when the lights were on him. But to me, what was more significant about it, in a time when voters are looking for authenticity, I mean, this is sort of explains Bernie Sanders' appeal in a big way, and even Donald Trump's. I mean, when I talk to voters, Trump supporters, again and again and again, they just say he's real, he says what he means, and that's what people want. And that particular slip-up of Rubio's, it sort of pulled the veil off, and it allowed people to say, oh, another sort of wind-up politician who is saying what he thinks he needs to say instead of what he really feels. So that's why I think that mistake was so significant.
I agree with you, and I think that, you know, having seen these candidates behind the scenes and then seeing them at the podium, you get a different perspective, and that authenticity that you're talking about, you know, it translates well for guys like Christie and Kasich, and certainly for Trump, the way he portrays himself. But folks that are scripted, both on and off camera, I think it really hurts in this cycle because people don't want to hear the rhetoric. They want to get to know and trust the person. Hard to do when you've got a canned speech.
Right, and that's an issue that's coming up again and again and again. I mean, Mr. DeSalvo, before we have to let you go, I mean, you are president of St. Anselm's College. You're surrounded by young people. This is something that we're going to talk about a little bit more later in the show, but there's been a lot of discussion around, you know, Bernie Sanders energizing young people. Do you have a sense as to what's really animating college students now in this election cycle?
So I think it's a little ironic that you have a 70-plus-year-old man who's energized the 20-something base, but he is talking about ideological issues that resonate with people who are in college or just out of college. When you get down to the particulars and you ask questions about how are you really going to pay for the free college, you know, the devil's in the details, and with a Republican Congress, probably not going to happen anyway. But he's saying things that hit at the heartstrings of these young people, and we are seeing it on our campus. I'm seeing it in my own home with my sons. These are the things that are exciting people. And I think it's extraordinary. I think he's going to do very well tonight. I don't know if he's got enough behind him to carry him through South Carolina and Super Tuesday, but he certainly has changed the conversation.
Mm. Well, that's Stephen DeSalvo. He's president of St. Anselm College, joining us today from Manchester. President DeSalvo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take a closer look at the reality of New Hampshire retail politics in the 2016 race. Here's how two Merrimack voters, Martha, who didn't give us her last name, and James Belsky, how they felt about that today.
Great. Yeah, it's finally good to have it here and get everybody out voting and get our state back to us.
I'm so glad today is here because now our phones will stop. It is just crazy.
So, listeners, you can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Anthony Brooks in Manchester.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We will be right back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks in Manchester, New Hampshire. We're talking about today's New Hampshire primary and what may be a turning point in American politics. With us is Dante Scala, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH and author of The Four Faces of the Republican Party, The Fight for the 2016 Presidential Nomination.
We're also happy to take your calls, whether or not you feel there's a disruption going on in American politics overall. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can send us a tweet as well at Radio Boston.
Disruption is a big theme of the presidential race so far, but is the special nature of the New Hampshire primary changing as well?
That's actually a question that was raised to us by some Granite State voters themselves over the past few days. Just listen to Brandon Laws, a bartender at the Peddler's Daughter Irish Pub in Nashua.
So 2008, when Obama was getting elected, I met, all of the candidates. They all came into the pub. You couldn't walk on the street without bumping into one of them, you know? I haven't seen one this entire cycle, but I've seen 1,000 people who work for them.
And one of those people, Phil Consuega, traveled up from Philadelphia to canvass for Marco Rubio.
I probably knocked on about 1,000 doors this weekend, and everybody's been very, very positive, very welcoming. They give candidates 1, 2, 3, 4 looks. They're very methodical about the way they go about things here. That's great to see.
But at least one longtime New Hampshire voter in Manchester sounded a more cautious note. She wasn't willing to give us her name out of concerns that it could affect her at work, but she did share that she's wondering, as America changes, should New Hampshire still go first?
It's okay that it's here, but the fact that it's here also means that it's not in a more diverse place. And it doesn't have a great diverse population, although it's starting to diversify. So we're leading the way by white people.
A Manchester voter there at Charlie's Homestyle Diner in Merrimack this morning. So, Dante Scott, I'd love for you to sort of chime in on this issue. I mean, tackle this any way you want, but, is the nature of the New Hampshire primary itself changing, or is there evidence that it might be changing in this election? One of the things that I'm thinking about is the way Donald Trump has run his campaign, and if he is to prevail, he would prevail without that traditional sort of retail-style politicking for which this political season is so famous in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, that would be something different in the sense of his style of campaigning, lack of ground game and so forth. Although, most candidates are following more traditional methods. I mean, we've had John Kasich do 100-plus town halls, mm-hmm. and Jeb Bush has followed suit. Even Marco Rubio, who's sometimes criticized for not doing enough town halls, has done dozens. And so, Trump is, it is a sense where the Trump wave has washed over New Hampshire, and in some ways Trump has run a national campaign that's resonated here. One way, I think, in which Trump upholds primary traditions is the sense in which primaries themselves can be quite disruptive of political parties in a democratic way. And that was the original purpose of primaries, to take it out of the hands of party elites and put it in the hands of ordinary people. And when you do that, you sometimes get disruption. And one of my favorite stories this cycle was by Byron York of the Washington Examiner. He was talking to a room of Republican elites, and they were all looking at each other saying, "Do you know any Trump voters? I don't know any Trump voters. There might be someone down the street. I think he might be a Trump voter." The elites had no clue where these people were coming from. And to me, even though Trump has done this in an unorthodox way, to me, that resonates a bit of the democratic, with a small d, nature of a primary, where people want to send a message sometimes, and they don't care what the elites think about it.
Really interesting. I'm wondering, too, what you think. I mean, just sort of staying on this theme, I want to ask you about Bernie Sanders' approach, too, because sometimes in talking about sort of the New Hampshire way, Donald Trump is often brought up as an example of, he's sort of violating that traditional way of retail politics. Bernie Sanders, of course, big grassroots following, but his campaign events, too, aren't the sort of traditional New Hampshire, haven't been the sort of traditional New Hampshire town hall meeting with questions. And, I mean, he comes in, tends to give the same speech, which lasts for about an hour, and then he leaves. I mean, is there an indication there as well that he's not adhering to that New Hampshire script?
Yeah, not so much the town halls. And it's interesting to follow the history of the town halls. In some sense, we think of them as venerable now, but really John McCain only in 2000 made them so as famous as they are. What's interesting about Sanders, I go to events and, you have to give your email as part of that. So I get things from everybody. And I got an email today from Bernie Sanders saying something like, "Dante, have you voted yet?" So they're, for the rallies are one thing, but they seem very careful and methodical about their ground game, making sure that their voters are getting to the polls.
Well, Anthony and Dante, stand by for just a second because I want to bring in another New Hampshire voice here just briefly. He's Paul Miller. He's the executive editor of the Keene Sentinel. He joins us today from Keene. Paul Miller, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So what's the day been like in Keene today so far?
Well, it is to be sure, a different sort of pulse in our newsroom, out on the streets, at the polls, and I think this is what makes New Hampshire primary day in New Hampshire so special. There is the undeniable sort of flurry and run-up that's not unlike Christmas to this day, and it's finally in the hands of the voters, and that's what it's all about at the end of the day.
You know, you heard us just now talking about whether or not sort of the hallmark aspects of the New Hampshire primary are changing this time around, retail politics, whether or not the power of big media or social media is playing a role here. I mean, what's your sense on the ground in Keene? Is this sort of campaigning as usual this time around in New Hampshire, or something different?
My sense is that it is different. It's not entirely different. You know, the mass media landscape is so dramatically changed. I think that has a large part to do with it. I think the unconventional sort of campaign and approach that Donald Trump has taken, how it all plays out is yet to be seen, has something to do with it. We'll have to see how that plays out. But, you know, it certainly is not the intimate exercise that I had known it for so many years to be, where, you know, you're politicking over pancakes and coffee at the local diner, and you get the face-to-face time, you get the handshake with the candidate. It still exists, but you have more of these, large auditoriums with sound systems and security guards, and you don't have the access to the candidates, even in our small state sometimes. And that matters. That resonates with voters. That's part of the tradition here. I'm not saying it's gone away entirely, but I do agree with a lot of the experts who feel that if Trump were to go on and do something significant, winning the nomination or even winning the presidency, you're talking about rewriting the playbook to a certain extent.
And Paul, does that sort of weaken the justification for this idea that New Hampshire goes first? I mean, every 4 years this debate comes up. It's a small state. It's not urban, it's mostly white, so on and so forth. Does that in some way weaken that argument even more?
Well, I suppose it does. I'm not sure you can stop that sort of spiral. It changes the atmospherics, you know, of the primary, doesn't it? Because everybody will be on the political landscape will be evaluating that to see what worked and what the new winning formula is. But, you know, the Hampshire primary is what it is. It's special. It has history. It has tradition. It has an unpredictability about it that that keeps it interesting every time we arrive at this place 4 years from now. You know, Andy Smith and David Moore wrote a fascinating op-ed for our paper today, rather lengthy but very interesting, and they ended their op-ed by saying it's important to remember that history feels no obligation to be consistent. To me, that's what the New Hampshire primary is. You know, we've been running on poll numbers like fuel for so many months now, and they don't mean a whole lot in New Hampshire, we've learned. So I think that's what it lends a sense of mystery about tonight still, and it's why we're all sort of in anticipation mode.
Well, Paul Miller is the executive editor of the Keene Sentinel. Thanks so much for joining us today, Mr. Miller.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, we're going to dive even deeper into that big question we've been asking. What does the New Hampshire primary say about the current state of the Democratic and Republican parties? And is there a major disruption going on across American politics? Here's a couple of frustrated Sanders and Trump voters.
He doesn't have the typical politician. He's got the business sense to be able to fix what's wrong with this country without bringing all this politics. I am sick of the top 1%, even though my relatives are there. I'm sick of it.
And when we come back, listeners, we want to hear from you. 1-800-423-8255. Join the conversation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Manchester.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks in Manchester, New Hampshire. And we're talking this hour about today's New Hampshire primary. Polls close in a few hours. We're talking about whether or not we're in the middle of some kind of disruption in American politics.
Let's listen to a couple New Hampshire voters right now. Maureen Hall says she voted for President Obama twice, but this time she wishes she had registered as an independent so she could have pulled a Republican ballot for John Kasich. But since she's still a registered Democrat, she cast her vote for Bernie Sanders, and here's why.
Because I don't like Hillary.
Why don't you like Hillary?
Because I don't trust her. And I don't like her husband, because I don't trust him.
And here's Wilfred Marquise of Hollis on why he voted for Donald Trump.
Because I can't stand any of the others, and I can't stand the Democrats. He's telling the truth. He's telling things that people should have heard a long time ago. I'd like to have somebody tell it like it is for a change, and maybe set some people to wake up and find out what the hell's going on in this country.
And one more piece of tape here from a Manchester voter who wouldn't give us her name because she's worried about her job, but she expressed a kind of frustration that transcends political party, a frustration with the political system itself.
I'm pretty frustrated with Democrat, Republican, and everyone in between because I don't think that there's a shred of honesty. I think that the process is about winning. It's not about the people, and that concerns me.
Listeners, we'd love to hear about you. Do you feel similar frustrations? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. We're asking you what this primary race in New Hampshire is telling us about the broader political culture across this country.
And we're joined by Dante Scala. He's a political science professor at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Four Faces of the Republican Party, The Fight for the 2016 Presidential Nomination. He's in Manchester alongside Anthony. But now let's bring in Alan Solomont. He's former U.S. ambassador to Spain and Andorra and dean of the College of Citizenship and Public Service at Tufts University. He joins me here in the studio in Boston. Dean Solomont and Ambassador Solomont, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Meghna. It's nice to be here.
So you've been watching politics for quite some time. Let me just ask you the question we've set up here. Do you think 2016 is indicating some kind of disruption in the American political system?
Presidential elections are inherently disruptive. This is an incredible exercise we go through every 4 years where the American people have a national conversation about the future of our country. And although I think there are some things happening in 2016 that are somewhat unprecedented, 1968 was a disruptive election. A sitting president withdrew from the race because of pressure from young voters in New Hampshire. 1980, President Reagan said government is the problem, not the solution. In 1992, a young governor from Arkansas moved the center of gravity of the Democratic Party to the center again. And certainly in 2008, nobody gave this first-term United States senator a chance. I remember when I first signed on with the Obama campaign, my friends thought I was nuts. But I will say that I think one of the things that could be most disruptive to American politics is if young people got engaged. Young people today are the largest block of eligible voters in this country. More so than my generation of seniors. So they're
We're talking young people, are we talking what?
18 to 29.
Okay.
Or in Iowa, 17, because they were those who were going to be 18 before the election could caucus. They're a hugely important force, and they're hugely impacted by public policy. They want to solve problems. They grew up in a diverse world. They're joining service organizations like AmeriCorps, but they aren't showing up at the polls. In 2014, voting by young people reached an all-time low of under 20%. That was an off, congressional elections. But even in 2012, voting by young people was down from 51% in 2008 to 45% in 2012. Having said that, and since there's all this talk about whether New Hampshire is a good example. Young people are hugely important in this primary. And they actually are both in, they were in Iowa and they will be in New Hampshire, probably more so in the, than in many other states.
Hey, Anthony, can I just turn a question back to you? Because, I mean, I personally, as a citizen, I take Dean Solomon's point that presidential elections, by definition, every 4 years produce a kind of disruption. But I get the sense in talking to you from all your reporting from the past couple of months that you feel like this disruption may have a slightly different tenor than we've seen before.
Well, you know, it's funny that maybe I think that's true. But, you know, it's interesting. I almost want to turn this question to Dante Scala, because I think, Dante, I was talking to you about this a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about a parallel with 2016 and the 2000 election, when there was, I'm pretty sure I had this conversation with you, when we had a real establishment candidate in Al Gore, vice president, and we saw a kind of not so much a Bernie Sanders type challenge, but definitely a challenge from the left, from Bill Bradley. So I think we tend to sort of get focused on the moment, and it sort of feels like completely new and unprecedented. But we've been down this road before. But I'd love you to sort of chime in on that issue.
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind, and this echoes Dean Solomon's point, is it's been 8 years since there's been a competitive Democratic Party primary. And for those 8 years, the party was centered around Barack Obama and getting him elected and then reelected. And that means a lot of discussions and arguments are essentially tamped down or set aside in service of the incumbent. Now, 8 years later, we're getting a glimpse of the post-Obama Democratic Party. And when you've got Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders arguing about who is more progressive or more authentically progressive, that's a glimpse into the new Democratic Party. And in some sense, there's a new generation that's grown up under Obama, come of age under Obama. And what's striking to me about this race so far is young women, 30 and under, who look at Hillary Clinton and say, kind of shrug a bit when they talk about her as an historical candidate. For them, for that generation, the Clintons don't mean what they used to mean for my generation and so forth. For them, Bill Clinton's more of a history lesson than a president. And I think Hillary bears some of the burden of that.
Yeah. Dean Solomon, jump back in here. What do you think?
Well, there is a division among women, and it does cut along age. Even within younger people, women over 25 are more likely to support Hillary Clinton than women under 25. And I think the idea of breaking that glass ceiling is something that's much more appealing to, or less appealing to many young women. We heard former Secretary of State Albright and feminist icon Gloria Steinem take young women to task recently. I'm not sure that was such a helpful to the Clinton campaign. I think the point that Professor Scala makes about forces that have been sort of percolating up over the last 8 years are coming to fruition. You know, money in politics, the partisanship that we've seen, the lack of civic education or even civic illiteracy, which I think contributes to the fact that, that young people are disengaged, and the growing inequality, which has alienated many from sort of mainstream politics because they felt alienated from mainstream economics.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, I do think that there is an opportunity to try to engage this generation. New Hampshire is a great example. In 2008, 43% of young people turned out in the New Hampshire primary. Now, a record number of young people caucused in Iowa, but it was only 11% of young people. So it's interesting what's going on in New Hampshire. Now, that's not going to be reflected in South Carolina and other states. And I think the thing that's happening on both sides, and especially on the Democratic side, is it's no question that Senator Sanders has found a way to tap into the energy and interest of young people.
Well, hold that thought for just a second, actually, because we've got some callers who want to chime in on exactly this topic. Dave is calling from Andover. You're on the air, Dave.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So my comment was that I think that young people, a big part of the reason that they don't show up is because they're not dumb, and they understand that the system, the political system, is fundamentally flawed. And I think that what a lot of young people like in Bernie Sanders, and maybe this is reminiscent of what they like with Obama, time will tell, is that they feel that he is sincere and that he is calling things as they are. And I guess that's what I'd like to say.
Dave, thanks for your call. Dante Scala, your thought on that?
Yeah, I've taught a lot of 18 and 22-year-olds in my time, and their nose for inauthenticity and their criticism of hypocrisy is very high. And so I think Sanders does pass that test with them, and I do think young voters prefer candidates who offer the prospect of a blank slate or wiping the slate clean and starting over. And that, you know, and Hillary Clinton is stuck basically saying, if you liked Obama, you'll like me. I will protect and advance his agenda, whereas Sanders is promising something else. And perhaps it's a little fuzzy on the details about how we're going to get there. But young people, I think, are willing to roll the dice a bit on that compared to more of the same.
What I'm interested in, though, and this is a question both for Dean Solomon and you, Dante Scala, and that is, you know, to what extent are we really we're talking about questions of authenticity and what appeals to young people, but what's also appealing to young people in the Sanders campaign is he's talking about stuff that really affects them as they come of age in a world that is no longer working for them so well. I mean, college debt, the cost of college, health care, how am I going to afford a house? How am I going to have a family? And in a way, I feel like that the sort of establishment Democratic Party has left this group of people behind, and that's what Bernie Sanders is tapping into. So we're really talking about a not just a fight for young people, but a fight within the Democratic Party to sort of redefine the soul of what the Democratic Party is.
I think you make a good point, Anthony. One of the great ironies is that Senator Sanders has held elective office far longer than either Secretary of State Clinton or, for that matter, Barack Obama. But he is talking about the future. And, you know, it was Bill Clinton that said that elections are about tomorrow, not about yesterday. And I think this is something that the Clinton campaign has to pay close attention to, because she's talking about following, you know, the legacy of Barack Obama. She's talking about her experience. And there's no question that she brings a great deal to the office of the president. But people really do want a vision for the future. And you're also right that young people are worried about their future economically. We tend to think about young people as somewhat monolithic. When the candidates were asked, Democratic candidates were asked at a debate what they're going to do for young people, they talked about college debt. Well, only 29% of young people are in college. 20% of young voters are parents. The single biggest issue that does unite young people is, am I going to get a job that I can afford?
Actually, Dean Solomon and Dante and Anthony, I want to underscore something that Anthony said, because I wonder, you know, in generations past, we've had issues like the prospect of getting drafted really helping to define, voting patterns for a generation of Americans. I do wonder whether or not, you know, this isn't just the first sort of open Democratic primary in 8 years. It's also eight years after a catastrophic economic, you know, virtual collapse that's really continues to feel like an anchor dragging down an entire generation of young people. I mean, is that sort of the context that we have to look here when we're talking about disruption? Like, could the economy really help set or define voting patterns for this enormous group of young people, not just for this election, but for, you know, for time to come?
If you're a first-time voter this year, if you're a first-time voter, then you have lived through an economic downturn since you were age 10.
Dante.
Yeah, I think, and what's interesting to me about Bernie Sanders' support in New Hampshire thus far is that it's not just young voters. It's not just upscale progressive voters. It's blue-collar, more moderate voters, working-class voters who typically go with the establishment candidate, who typically are suspicious of these insurgents with their grand ideas and all that. This time around, it seems as if Sanders is holding his own among those voters. And to me, I think it gets back to this question of economic anxiety, which also is driving a lot of the Trump vote, this sense that my prospects are dim. I never recovered from the Great Recession. I don't live the life my father lived or probably my grandfather lived. I'm not sure what kind of life my kids are going to have. And when you have that kind of economic pressure and anxiety, I think you're looking for other things.
You know, it's interesting. Speaking of looking for other things, I mean, this gets to the point, one of the challenges facing Hillary Clinton, I was really struck by something her husband said over the weekend when he was campaigning for her. He went after Bernie Sanders, and he was talking about, among other things, Sanders' call for Medicaid for all. And I'm not going to get this phrase exactly right, but he said something to the effect that the New Hampshire that I knew wouldn't have supported that. And in a way, that was such a telling statement because, you know, I could imagine young people sort of listening to that and saying, we're not the New Hampshire you knew. I mean, we want to talk about an America that we're growing up in. So that seems to be one of Clinton's challenges here.
You know, the electorate is not only changing in terms of age, but it's also changing in terms of ethnicity. The largest, fastest growing part of our population is the Hispanic community. The group that has supported President Obama more than any other group have been Latino women. Black men have also been among the most significant supporters of President Obama in both 2008 and 2012. So one thing that, and I think this is an advantage for Secretary of State Clinton, but it'll be also very telling to see how she does in upcoming primaries that are states that don't look like New Hampshire or Iowa, is whether she's able to appeal to those diverse voters.
Right. Well, our callers are always so patient, aren't they, Anthony?
They are indeed. We've got a bunch of them.
Yes. Yeah, so let's get another one in here. Eileen's calling from Watertown. You're on the air, Eileen.
Hello. So I don't mean to rain on your parade, but I do think it's too early to say whether this is a disruptive election. It's just too early in the whole process. My other comment was that while I can't seem to drag myself away, all this horse race talk is so tiring sometimes. Sorry.
That's okay. Eileen, we like being rained on sometimes. It we find it refreshing.
I brought my umbrella.
But Dante, what do you think? It's too early to talk about any kind of disruption. I mean, Eileen's point is it's just the primaries. There's a whole lot more to unfold as the months go forward.
Yeah, and I can personally vouch for the fact that the ratio of noise to actual signals from voters is very high. And everyone is pontificating, and I throw myself among them, about the meaning of this and the meaning of that. And we just don't know until this whole thing plays out. And it's, you know, what does Donald Trump mean? You know, we think we know something, but it's all kind of darkness until we actually start to see some votes and some patterns emerge. Everything else is just guesswork.
I couldn't agree more. However, it also is good that people are tuned in. This is a very big deal, electing a president. It has a profound effect on our country, both in the world and on the lives of American citizens. And so it's good that people are engaged and that we go through, what some people might describe as a amusing exercise or even a circus. But the fact that people are tuned in and thinking about this, and I suppose one could even argue the fact that candidates like Donald Trump have brought people who otherwise wouldn't be paying attention into the process is not a bad thing. So that might be one of Donald Trump's great contributions this year.
I'm really curious about looking forward, and I want to, Meghna, we should make time to go back to some more calls, but just speaking of Donald Trump, we've been talking a lot about Sanders and Clinton, but I'll start with you, Dante. I mean, let's say Donald Trump continues to prevail and does get the Republican nomination. What does that do to the Republican Party?
It becomes Trump's party.
That's not the Republican. That's a long way from the Republican Party
exactly.
Today, right?
Well, absolutely. And there's, but it would have some, I think it would have ramifications in terms of, you know, how will, you know, minorities respond to a Trump candidacy. I mean, already we see the Republican Party has real problems putting together a coalition of voters that can win in presidential years. They're good at midterms, but not so much with that more diverse electorate that turns out every 4 years. A Trump candidacy would, you know, certainly exacerbate tensions that the party sees right now. On the one hand, they need white working class voters. They need their support. On the other hand, they need to diversify their party because the country is only going to become more diverse. Difficult to see at this juncture how Trump could be that bridge to a more diverse America and a more diverse Republican Party that seems inevitable if the party's going to flourish in the future.
Well, we just have literally 30 seconds to go. Dean Solomon, do you have a final 10-second thought for us?
One rule of presidential politics always was is that the side that was the party that was more united was the party that would win. I think that it'll be interesting to see two parties, both of whom have divisions, but I think the Republican Party may have many more fault lines than the Democrats.
Well, Alan Solomon is Dean of the College of Citizenship and Public Service at Tufts University and former U.S. Ambassador to Spain and Andorra. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Megan.
And Dante Scala of the University of New Hampshire, thank you so much for coming in. It was a great pleasure having you.
You're very welcome.
Well, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Anthony Brooks.
This is Radio Boston.